Coming up this week on the show, we got an interview with Dag Erling Smorgov, the current security officer of FreeBSD, to discuss what exactly being in such an important position is like. And of course, we're going to have the latest news, answers to your emails, and even some Libra SSL drama. Fun, fun, right here on BSD Now, the place to be. SD. BSD Now, episode 47, Desk Challenge IV, recorded July 23rd, 2014. Hey, I'm your host, Chris Moore.
And I'm Alan Ju.
And we're glad to have you guys with us this week. We got another good, exciting show coming at you. Lots of interesting news to get into, so we'll get right to that. So first up, looks like OpenBSD had a hackathon in Slovenia. About 50 developers gathered July 8th to the 14th. Wow, that's a long hackathon. Exactly. That's cool, though. But, you know, when they spend that much time together, naturally they're going to get a lot of work done. And this hackathon was no exception. So I guess just the true first weeks of July alone, there was over 1,000 commits to their CVS tree. Wow. That is pretty cool.
I didn't end up getting time, but I meant to see how much there was in the FreeBSD tree in that time.
Yeah. But that is awesome. Yeah, that's what happens when you get people together and have FaceTime. It's just
And it's kind of the FreeBSD developers, there's some like that and there's some that aren't. Like, oftentimes it's more high-level discussions and deciding things rather than actually just sitting down and working, although we often have the hackers lounge with that kind of thing actually happens. But it's always interesting to see the stuff that comes out of the dev summits and the hackathons. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they have trip reports from lots and lots and lots of people.
Yes. Almost too many to mention here, but we'll try and
a couple. Bob Beck was planning to work on the kernel at the hackathon, but then some Libre SSL stuff happened with the Linux pseudo random number generator, so he spent most of his time with that. Moid Bellet worked on Libre SSL.
Yep.
And talks about that.
And Brett Cook, and one guess what he worked on? Oh, Libre SSL.
Yep. Okay. And actually, we're going to be interviewing him next week, so stay tuned for that. Henning Brower actually worked on not Libre SSL. He worked on VLAN packet BPF for doing various things, and also IPv6 and network interface stuff. And he says that he still hates IPv6.
Then Martin, it looks like, fixed some bugs in the USB stack, SoftRAID, and among other things. Mark Espy improved package code, enabling some speedups, fixed some ports that broke with Libre SSL, and some of the new changes did some work on ensuring snapshot consistency. So that's pretty cool.
Martin Pelican integrated read-only EXT4 support, so you can match your EXT4 Linux file systems. Fadim Zukov did lots of work on ports, including working on getting KDE 4 into OpenBSD.
Mm-hmm. And what did Theo do? It looks like he created a more secure system call send syslog and did a lot of work in etsy, sysmerge, and rc scripts. And Paul, how do you pronounce the last name?
Lerafti?
Worked on the USB stack. So that's
and specifically
cool.
For the Octeon platform, which is one of the little embedded processor things.
Mm-hmm.
Sebastian worked on RelayD filters and more IPv6 stuff. Jasper worked on Puppet packages and the bootloader. Jonathan Gray imported even newer MESA libraries and did a lot of work on Xenokara, which is the OpenBSD fork of Xorg, including work on installer for... our work in the installer for auto detection on X stuff. Stefan Sperling fixed a lot of issues with wireless drivers. That's always good to see. Florian Obser did IPv6. Ingo Suarez worked on Mandoc and rewrote a bunch of the CGI interfaces, including the way you read the man pages on the openbsd.org is much improved now. That was nice to see.
And Ken Westerback hacked on DH client and DHCPD and got dump working on 4K sector drives. Nice. And Matthew Herb looks like worked on updating and modernizing parts of Xenokara as well. So Dang, that's a lot of stuff happened in during their hackathon.
They had quite the hackathon.
So, yeah, that's like a whole release cycle's worth of stuff right there. Yep. Here we go. Just a couple weeks.
That was most of that happened in the 1 week while they were there.
Nice.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Nice, yeah. That's really cool. Next up, this is actually kind of a hot topic at the moment, but the FreeBSD PF discussion has really taken off. I know we've mentioned this the last couple of weeks, but it has just kind of gone to new heights from there.
Yeah, I guess so it started over on the PF mailing list and then moved over to FreeBSD questions and then FreeBSD current and to involve more people. And, it started off with someone just kind of wondering what's the status of PF and what's the plan going forward.
Mm-hmm.
And went kind of crazy from there. But one of the people that's done a lot of the work on PF, he had made a reply on here, and he was saying that as of right now, he's not aware of anyone doing active development on PF on FreeBSD specifically. And he says that following OpenBSD on features would be very cool to get any features that the newer PF on OpenBSD has, but doing bulk imports of their changes probably wouldn't be possible anymore because of the changes from not only the SMP stuff, but vImage and a bunch of other things, and just how different the networking stacks are between FreeBSD and OpenBSD. And also just bulk imports like that often produce bad quality ports of PF, and it'd be better to actually pick out individual features, import them, and make those work well rather than trying to just take everything. And so I guess one of the questions that came out of that is, what features are there in newer OpenBSD PF that people on FreeBSD really want? So what's the priority there?
Well, I guess a lot of that, of course, is going to be newer syntax and whatnot.
Well, there's newer syntax, but other than that, is there actually a feature in PF that's missing currently?
So we also have some interesting reports here from Baptiste kind of pointing out that multi-thread support is not the only difference between FreeBSD and OpenBSD versions.
And that's obviously further complicates any kind of bulk import.
Definitely. Such as like vImage support, for example.
Yeah. Even though PF and vImage don't get along very well, there's a lot of plumbing that went on there. And then as we mentioned before, I remember at VBSDCon, some people got Baptiste drunk and made him agree to work on importing some of the newer PF stuff. And I hadn't really heard anything about it. And when I asked him about it, he replied on the mailing list saying that he had made some efforts to actually update FreeBSD's PF with some of the newer stuff from OpenBSD PF. But he ran into some problems and ended up breaking PF. And so he had to revert his changes. And he says that while he's still somewhat interested in porting individual PF features that are relevant to the way he uses PF over, he doesn't think a full sync is really practical, and he's not interested in doing a full sync or being the overall maintainer of PF and FreeBSD, but he would be willing to work on specific features if they were of value to him.
It's not like he's busy enough, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that's what he says. He was working on it, but then, you know, we got all these great ideas on what to do with the package system in 1.3, which just came out, and 1.4 and 1.5. You know, 1.5, we're barely starting on 1.4, and we already have plans for what's going to be in 1.5.
That's right.
And so, you know, he's pretty busy. Plus, you know, he has a day job still. So,
Sure. Only so many hours to go around, and sounds like we need some volunteers to step up.
Well, specifically, yeah. We're looking for
CPF updated.
Volunteers are people that actually want to do the work. You know, basically everyone on the mailing list agrees that updating PF would be a good thing. Just nobody really wants
Who's
to do it.
Do it?
And so, looking for people to actually work on that. There's
Looks
mentorship
like they have
available.
Mentorships. They're available.
If you're working on it and you run into a very specific problem, there are people you can ask, and they're more than willing to help. They just can't shoulder the entire thing themselves. Even Henning Brouwer, the guy who wrote a lot of PF and OpenBSD, says he said on multiple occasions he's very willing to help people understand his code and, you know, answer questions and help get it ported over. And then for funding, you know, if you're interested in actually doing the work, you can apply to the FreeBSD Foundation for funding, and they fund projects like this.
Yeah, this would be a good candidate, I think, for a FreeBSD Foundation project.
Exactly. And a lot of times it can just come down to someone actually starting the work in order to get other people excited about working on it together. right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, you know, Libre SSL. They one person kind of came up with the idea and started working on it, and then everybody jumped in to help. And yep. I think that's all that's really missing here is
that somebody's just got to grab the flag and run with it on this one, and everyone else will start helping out, hopefully.
Exactly. Like, that's how we got ZFS and the FreeBSD installer. It's like, mm-hmm. Everybody thought it was a good idea, but nobody had done it. And so I sat down mm-hmm. on an airplane and started working on it, and I came up with a horrible draft that wasn't that useful, but talking about it and working with people, we actually got other people involved and got excited about it, and we built it, and then it's been improved, and it's gone very well. And so I think, yeah, it just comes down to, you know, the blank page is the hardest place to start. So if we get mm-hmm. Somebody that wants to actually get their hands dirty and get some of the work done, they might actually be able to help. And there are mm-hmm. actually other ways to help. If you're not, say, the kernel programmer that can work on firewalls.
Sure.
It's part of the problem.
Definitely.
Yeah, part of the problem is that searching for documentation online for PF is troublesome because the syntax between OpenBSD and FreeBSD have diverged now. Mm-hmm. And FreeBSD's man pages and some of the documentation still point to OpenBSD for the rest of the documentation. Sure. And now that OpenBSD has updated their documentation, it doesn't actually make sense anymore. Yeah.
That doesn't work like it's supposed to, according to the example.
Yeah, so some of the FreeBSD documentation could be beefed up to be correct for what's currently in the system. And, you know, even if that's just going through the OpenBSD archives and pulling out some of that documentation from the older version and sorting mm-hmm. it out.
Mm-hmm. I guess the discussion even talked about importing PF patches from PFSense, though.
Yes. So the guys at PFSense have been doing some work to mm-hmm. improve the PF that they use, specifically because they're working towards moving to FreeBSD 10 for some of the additional SMP changes that went into PF in FreeBSD. And so they've been mm-hmm. porting over some features and patches and stuff. But there's been some questions about what the license they'll have on those yeah. patches are. And I imagine it'll be fine. It's just a matter of actually...
Got to clarify it.
Yeah, getting people talking and finding, you know, time. mm-hmm. You know, everybody's very busy. And
true.
It's just a matter of sorting that out and making that actually happen.
Well, it looks like the threads kind of got a little off topic as some more disagreements came up.
Some people were not being helpful and being like, oh, well, I just use IPFW, so I don't care. It's like, sure, yeah. but...
That didn't add anything to the conversation.
Right.
That's good for you, though.
It is important to remember that PF isn't the only firewall in FreeBSD. IPFW sure. is very good and very fast. The place where I find it lacking is doing NAT. I can do everything else in IPFW, and I'm very happy with it, and I use it even on top of PF sometimes because, you know, the dummy net flow control stuff is very, very powerful and I love it. Yeah. It's just when I'm doing elaborate NAT, basically when I need to do port forwarding with NAT, I end up having mm-hmm. to use PF. But when I'm just, you know, when I was at the FreeBSD Developer Summit and I fired up a Beehive and I needed to NAT it out to the internet, I could just use IPFW. I knew all the commands off the top of my head and it was easy to do. But yeah, it was a bit more complicated if I wanted to do, you know, if I was doing port forwarding just into that Beehive, again, I could do that. It's easy in IPFW. It's just when you get more mm-hmm. complicated rule sets and you want to be able to change stuff, it's sometimes PF is better. So yeah, it was just many things happen there, but yes, many users were very vocal about wanting the newer PF. Although some of the developers questioned, well, which features of the newer PF did you want? Like, mm-hmm. you can't just, you know, we want the latest because it's the latest. We need, like, what specific features are missing that you want, and we can actually maybe get that done. You know,
sure.
Asking for small things is easier. Ask mm-hmm. for one feature definitely. At a time instead of just saying, we want everything now.
Definitely. Well, cool. So I guess the only known problem with FreeBSD PF is IPv6 fragments and, of course, some of the vImage quirks
yeah.
that still exist. Looks like Gleb Smirnov chimed in as well about some of the FreeBSD-specific SMP patches, saying that Henning's claims of OpenBSD's improved speed are uncorroborated.
Well, so, yeah, there was no,
either side is really published
a video from. Well, actually, we did have.
You did find one?
Yes, we do have some benchmarks of comparing FreeBSD 9.2 and FreeBSD 10 to OpenBSD 5.4. So the benchmarks are from like November of 2013, so they're not the latest, but it's, you know, mostly represents what's was current at the time. And mm-hmm. Henning says that in OpenBSD, they made some improvements in specifically with the algorithms and the locking and stuff that made it about 4 times faster. But whereas the SMP had, you know, obviously its own effects. But Olivier Coquard-Levay from the FreeBSD or the BSD router project, BSD router, which they basically make an appliance-y version of FreeBSD designed to replace a Cisco router. Right. Rather mm-hmm. than, you know, pfSense is kind of designed to replace your home router. This is to replace an enterprise router. So it's like doing BGP and stuff as opposed to NAT. And they ran some benchmarks on, I think it was a quad core machine with 10 gig internet or 10 gig Ethernet cards. And so they have not only just the graph of the results, but they actually provide the raw data from their experiments and the scripts they use so that you could rerun it on different hardware and see how that changes it or make certain tweaks and see if you can, you know, change the numbers and get different results. And
interesting.
Yeah, it's the more proper approach to benchmarking. It's like you don't just give us your results. You give us everything so that we could get the same results if we had the same hardware. And so we can run it on different hardware and see how that goes.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at his graph here. Some interesting results here about the Core's FreeBSD 10 slightly faster than some of the benchmarks to 9.2, but quite a bit faster than OpenBSD 5.4.
Yeah,
for forwarding PF stateful.
Yeah, at a certain point, OpenBSD runs into the limits of not having SMP, and it's something they're working on. But
sure,
yeah,
interesting. Okay, definitely, there will probably be ongoing discussion about this in the next.
But
few
in
weeks,
general,
I would imagine
everybody agrees that updating PF is a good thing. It's just a matter of, for some people, it's more of a priority than it is for other people, and it comes down to somebody actually has to do the work. So hopefully someone will volunteer.
Cool. Okay, next up in the news, moving on to something new, but yeah, we've been talking about it for a while now, LibreSSL progress update. So I guess LibreSSL's first few portable releases, of course, have come out, and they're making great progress. They've released 2.03 a couple days ago.
Yep.
A lot of non-OpenBSD people are now starting to get involved, sending in patches via the tech mailing list, so that's awesome.
Yeah, specifically, you know, now that they have the portable version, people are actually starting to run it on Mac OS X and FreeBSD and Linux and so on, and they're finding certain problems. And
of course, there's already been some drama associated with all this.
Yes, one developer found what he called a catastrophic failure of the pseudo-random number generator, whereas, you know, if you construct it a certain circumstance, you could cause it to give the same random number twice. Obviously fixed that, but in general, that you can't have a process and its child process end up with the same process ID number. That normally wouldn't happen, but they fixed the problem anyway, and that's why we have 203 available. Okay. Actually, I think the fix for that was actually 202, so 203 probably fixes something else.
And the problem they could really affect OpenBSD. Right. I guess it was just the portable version.
It was, yeah, just the way it was implemented on Linux. And actually, to solve that, it looks like some core Linux kernel developers are working on building a system call analogous to the get entropy system call on OpenBSD, so that it'll actually be so LibreSSL and a bunch of other things can actually get the more direct access. Specifically, basically allows you to get entropy that you would normally get by opening a dev urandom, except for without having to open a file handle, so that you can't do an attack against LibreSSL by exhausting all the available file handles, so that LibreSSL isn't able to get random from dev random or dev urandom.
Sure,
so it's actually doing it as a system call, so it doesn't involve opening a file.
Oh, that's nice.
Yes. It was interesting to see. You know, from one side, there was Linux people trying to say, no, this LibreSSL is crap or whatever. And then you have core developers like Theodore So saying, like, how to get the entropy is really good. We should do that.
Yeah. And this should be something we could use elsewhere, probably.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. But I guess Ten Unix, who we've interviewed in the past, also had some good words to say, really good post on the whole situation. Definitely you should check it out. I mean, the title is "This is Why Software Sucks." So, I mean, obviously you got to read it just based on that alone.
Yes.
But just following up how some of the stuff's been happening here with the LibreSSL release, the portable release, and, you know, if you don't want it to suck, you need to learn to get rid of some of these APIs that make it suck. Like, let's trim the fat here and really make this good.
And to that end, we asked Brian Drury last week about if they had done what's called an exp run, which is compiling everything in the ports tree with certain settings to see if it breaks with LibreSSL. And Baptiste mm-hmm. followed up and told us that they had actually started doing that, but that it currently broke a lot of things. And so slowly slogging through addressing that and figuring out how many of those are maybe just a small false positive or something, or how many of them mm-hmm. are like the Python thing where an application is just making a bad assumption that,
sure.
you know, if we have any SSL library, we'll have this feature, which maybe we actually won't, and maybe it's mm-hmm. not actually that big of a deal. And then some of them might actually be, you know, some incompatibility where a change has to be upstream to fix it.
Sure, sure.
So it'll be interesting to see how that progresses as well.
Cool. Okay, next up in the news, preparation for NetBSD 7 is now underway. It looks like the release process has kicked off. The NetBSD 7 CVS branch should be created around July 26, so in just a couple days here, which will mark the start of the first beta period, which should last until September. So if you're running NetBSD, this would actually be a great time to help test this on as many platforms as you can get your hands on. This is especially true if you're running on custom embedded platforms or toasters, etc. We want to find out which toasters work and which don't. But they're also looking for help updating docs. So if you want to get involved, help update their docs, fix any bugs that get reported, that would be great. And you can always hit up the links we'll have in the show notes afterwards. Also, they will have another formal announcement coming when the beta binaries go online, which, of course, I'm sure we will announce here in a future episode as well. So definitely keep an eye out for that. Exciting stuff. Lots of cool releases going on. Okay. Now, before we go into our next segment, though, we do need to mention our sponsor for this week, which, of course, we're going to start with Tarsnap today. So before we get started, the URL, tarsnap.com/BSDnow. Check it out. Let them know that we sent you. And this week we have also a link to a blog post from Michael W. Lucas.
Good buddy, Tarsnap is, as we've discussed, online backup for the truly paranoid. And while it's available in all of the package repos for, you know, FreeBSD, OpenBSD, NetBSD, Linux, etc., so you can easily just get Tarsnap from your local package repo and be happy, if you're truly paranoid, that's not good enough for you. So... Sure. Michael Lucas has this installing and using Tarsnap for fun and profit post where he talks about he had built an e-commerce site to direct sale of his books and now he needs to back that up. And so he talks about why he picked Tarsnap. It's very much like tar, so he didn't have to learn a new command line syntax. And he says, if you're not familiar with tar, you really should be.
Yeah, I say that's a good excuse to learn.
Yep. The terms of service for this are actually human readable and are very much more reasonable than what you get with a lot of backup services. You know,
I mean, my lawyer doesn't have to read it to tell me you're really getting screwed over.
A lot of work to make sure that that's readable by regular people and understandable as well. Mm-hmm. The code for the client is actually open and auditable. You can actually take a look at it, make sure, and take that code and compile it yourself, rather than maybe using the package from a repo or something, so that you know the code you just audited is exactly what you got when you compiled it.
Sure.
And he also says, when the Tarsnap author screws up, he admits it and handles it correctly. And he says, it's cheap. Any backup system that's priced in Pico dollars gets his attention.
Definitely.
And then he also adds that he also sees Colin Percival, the author of and the owner of Tarsnap, at BSD conferences on a regular basis. And he can slap him in person if he does something truly daft.
So you can't do that with various other providers we could mention.
So he mentions, you know, what you need to get started is GNUPG, which you can install from your package system, or Bootstrap, again, with the same kind of stuff. And then a compiler, which, you know, FreeBSD already comes with, make, OpenSSL, glib, system header files, and so on. So if you go to the Tarsnap download page, you can download that quick and then use your GPG to actually verify the signature on the code and make sure that what you got wasn't modified by somebody between what Colin published on his website and what you actually got, and make sure they're the same thing. And then from that, you just run the configure script and compile it and install it. And then you set up your key and you're good to go. And it walks you through taking a backup, seeing what backups are already on the service, you know, taking a second backup so you get your incremental, seeing the list and seeing how much space each of those is taking, and so on and so on. So that's kind of that walkthrough of using Tarsnap that way, you know, if you're just getting started, you can kind of see what's going on.
Sure. definitely very simple to get started. And of course, you can just sign up for an account on their site. And as he mentions, just put a couple bucks in it, $5.
That's,
suffice,
that's the other thing.
It's not a lot to
exactly.
get started.
That's the other thing is, unlike a lot of cloud services, you put the money in and then use it. So you can't spend more than you meant to because you only have available the funds you put in.
Sure.
And you know, that means you don't end up with a runaway bill that you weren't expecting.
Definitely. Well, cool. Well, again, that URL, tarsnap.com/BSDnow. Go ahead and check that out. Let them know that we sent you here on BSD Now. And we'll be back with our next segment in just a moment.
This week, we're joined by a senior engineer at the University of Oslo and the FreeBSD security officer, Dag Erling Smørgreve. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Yes. So I guess the first question we always ask is, how did you first get into BSD?
I first got into FreeBSD when a friend of mine lent me, I think it must have been 215 or 216, probably 215 CD. And I installed that. I was into the demo scene at the time. And a bunch of us had been talking loosely about writing some sort of operating system that would be specialized for demos that would provide more than DOS but not get in the way. And so we started talking about operating systems, and we somehow, somebody ended up sending us a 216 CD. And I installed that and liked it. And started, I got on some of the mailing lists, started talking to people, and then I think around 221 or 222, I more or less converted to FreeBSD, and have been using it continuously since then. And at some point, not long thereafter, I found a bug in Syscons, and I fixed it, and I mailed in the patch, and Jordan offered me a commit bit. Mm-hmm. So that's how it started.
Yeah, and so I guess now, what features or things in the base system can we blame you for?
Oh, well, libfetch and fetch. I'm the OpenSSH maintainer. I wrote OpenPAM, so our PAM implementation, and I've either written or rewritten most of our modules. I've done some kernel work, some device driver work. I did quite a bit on Syscons. I wrote the graphical screensavers for the console. That was something I think Jordan told me. He knew that I had some experience with Syscons. Mm-hmm. And he said, we have this PR about graphical screensavers. People have been asking for them. And this was the end of December. And he said, if you can get one or two written by the end of the year, then they won't be able to say that they've been asking for years. Something like that. So I wrote a simple side-scrolling parallax star fields, and I think that and the rain screensaver were the first, and I wrote them in about, well, a few hours and committed them so they would be in the tree before the end of the year, back in 98, I think. What else? You know, it's been 16, so I started using FreeBSD 96, mm-hmm. 95 or 96, probably 96, and I've been a committer since 98, so...
lots.
I've touched lots of things. It's not always easy to remember what you've what you've touched. So outside FreeBSD, there's OpenPAM, which is semi-independent of FreeBSD, and Varnish mostly. I was one of the original authors there. Paul Henning did most of the work. I did some of the portability and the build system and some of the early the LRU, first iteration of the LRU cache and things like that. If you'd asked me that question in advance, I could have made a list.
Right.
But
you decided to interview like 5 minutes ago. Well, yesterday, but and then so you're also the FreeBSD security officer. So can you tell
yes,
us a little
I have
what
been.
Your role is there?
Oh, sorry. So, on the surface, you could say that from the user's perspective, from the user's point of view, the security officer is this guy who makes sure that security advisories get written and published. But it's actually a lot more than that, the security officer charter actually states that the security officer is responsible for the security of the operating system. I don't remember the exact wording, but so on paper, I am responsible for every single security hole in the system, not just for fixing it, but I also have a more of a sort of overarching responsibility for trying to prevent them and for trying to improve our processes, improve our code, work on mitigation, exploit mitigation, and things like that. So most of the day-to-day work, obviously, is handling security advisories, which is quite a lot of work, but I have a good team and an excellent deputy who does that very well. But last year, we had the entire DevRandom kerfuffle, for lack of a better word. And that was also, so that is an example of one of the security officer's responsibilities that goes beyond merely responding to security bugs or to vulnerabilities, because I was then responsible for deciding how we were going to handle this. What did we want going forward? I was initially in favor of allowing direct access to RDRAN, to the hardware RNGs, and then we had discussions back and forth. And in the end, it was mostly me sitting down with Mark Murray and hashing it out, because he wrote it, and he's doing most of the work on the new version. He has a new version now that that we've been looking at the last couple of days, and that we'll be looking at some more later today. You could. That's more of I wouldn't say a strategic role, but it's sort of deciding which security features we want FreeBSD to have as well.
Right. And just prioritizing. Prioritizing, and trying to get.
So another example, something I did very recently that I've been wanting to do for a long time, but I finally did it recently, and that I'd like to get the word out so that people are aware of it. In the ports tree, there is now a feature where you can embed a CPE, so common platform enumeration data, in packages. There is a wiki page, wiki.freebsd.org/ports/CPE, that explains why and how. And the idea is that we want as many packages as possible to have that information embedded. And when it's there, we can use package ng, we can use package query to retrieve that information from the list of installed packages, or even from the repo metadata. So we can build a list of the CPE URIs for software that is installed on your system and compare that to the list of known vulnerabilities that you get from the National Vulnerability Database. Mm-hmm. And and maybe discover that you actually have a vulnerable version of whatever that we weren't aware of because we never got the advisory or something.
Right.
And
like a more standardized way to enumerate what's on the system to compare it to
and
the main vulnerability list instead of something like VUXML.
Yes, and based on established and widely used standards, whereas VUXML is something that only we use.
Right.
Also, VUXML was designed for the original port system where a port is identified by name dash version, and there might be a prefix in front of it, etc. So it's based on string matching, and it's very fragile, and you often get false, which is very, very bad. You often get false negatives.
Right.
So especially if a port is renamed, or if you have multiple versions of the same port, or if you have a port that has options so that it is sometimes installed with a different name depending on the build options, and quite often the VUXML entry only catches one of the variants of the port. It doesn't catch all of them. So port audit tells you you're safe, but you're not actually. Mm-hmm. The flip side of this is that the NVD is obviously a security database, and it can sometimes take a few weeks before from the moment a vulnerability is published with a CVE number until the database is updated, but any software that has ever had a CVE, that has ever had a vulnerability that had a CVE number assigned to it, has an entry in the CPE dictionary, Common Platform Enumeration Dictionary, which you can also download from the NVD website, nvd.nist.org, I believe. The syntax is very simple, and in many cases, you can get away with just enabling the CPE feature, and the port system will automatically generate the correct CPE information. In many, but far from most cases, but in most cases, you only have to tweak a thing or two, like for Perl, for instance, the correct vendor name and product name are both Perl, and that's our guess, so we're fine. For Apache, the vendor name is Apache, and the product name is HTTP server.
Right.
So you have to specify that. So this is something I really, really want to see widely used, and please look at the wiki page, and please look through your ports, and if there has ever been a security advisory relating to one of your ports with a CVE number assigned to it, then your port has a CPE and you should add it to the package.
Is there a way to get a CPE without ever having had a vulnerability, especially for, say, new software?
You can probably contact MITRE. There probably is a way. So a CPE is made up of a vendor name and a product name and a version number, etc. So it should be fairly easy to guess what your CPE is going to be, even if you haven't had one assigned to you. But it's probably better to contact MITRE. If you go to cpe.mitre.org, there is a link there there are links there to different pages with different for instance the entire dictionary and a search engine, etc. And there should be a contact address there somewhere where you can contact them and ask for it. But you'd have to be the author, I guess, of that software to request a CPE.
Mm-hmm.
So please. CPE in ports.
Yes. So yes, that brings us to the software you're building now. Could you tell
software
us
that I'm building now? Yes. So you're referring to Crib.
Yes.
This is another project that's been sort of in the slow cooker for actually for 2 years. I needed some. I needed an oath. Oath two-factor, so a one-time password, TOTP, HOTP, whatever implementation for work, the same algorithm that is used by Google Authenticator. And at that time, I think the only available implementation was there was Google Authenticator itself, and there was a command line implementation used by OpenBSD. And I needed something for FreeBSD, and I implemented that, and I started gathering that code and the bits of ancillary code I'd written for that, and collected it into a library which I, after long consideration, ended up naming Crib, C-R-Y-B, which is a collection of cryptographic algorithms. Mm-hmm. And the philosophy, you could say, behind Crib is to have a collection of cryptographic algorithms focusing on completeness and correctness with 100% unit test coverage, 100% documentation, so every single API function is documented, a stable, clean API with guaranteed ABI stability, and an unambiguous license. So since much of that code was written for my employer, I chose with my employer's permission, of course, to publish it under the three clause BSD license. And I have obtained permission from, so I took some code from Colin Percival's libc Perciva, which he granted me permission to re-license under the three clause BSD license. And I obtained permission from the author of ZSSL, Christophe Devine, to relicense ZSSL under the three-clause BSD license. So I'm currently working on integrating ZSSL into Crib. And when that work is done, I will have a fairly complete collection of message digests, message authentication codes, MAX, and RSA, AES, a few ciphers, RC4. So a good starting point. By no means a complete collection, but a good starting point. And hopefully the core of something that can be useful. I already have, I've discussed it here at BSD CAM, and I already have a volunteer for SHA-3, which is a completely different beast from SHA-1 and SHA-256 and 512. So I expect to publish the code within about a month or something. It will be on crib.to, cryb.to. I'm looking forward to seeing where which direction Crib will go, how it will be received by the community. And so my ambition is not to replace OpenSSL,
right,
or LibreSSL or whatever. I want a collection of algorithms with complete test coverage and complete documentation. That's the primary goal.
Mm-hmm. And so, how do you envision that being used? Like, would that be then go as part of the base system well, FreeBSD and be used for instance, stuff? Or?
Yes. So Crib is designed to be modular, which means that you could fairly easily, if you have an application, you don't want to have any external dependencies, but you need SHA-256, you can take this file and that file from Crib, and you just remove those five lines of code at the bottom that reference something else, and you have a SHA-256 implementation that you can use, that you can embed into your application without any other dependencies. It cannot replace OpenSSL in, for instance, Fetch, right, because it does not implement TLS. But it can replace libcrypto pretty much everywhere. So wherever FreeBSD uses message, especially message digests, because they're used for password hashing. Or I am probably going to pull in... to include key derivation functions, PBKDF. Mm-hmm. Oath will be included, of course. So the Google Authenticator, the algorithm that is used for by Google Authenticator for one-time passwords, which I've been meaning to import into, I already have a working implementation of that. I've been meaning to import it into FreeBSD for, well, ever since I wrote it 2 years ago. I haven't done it because I don't have a full range of management tools, so key generation, key, etc. There, I have those tools, but they're specialized for the system for which I implemented them at work at the University of Oslo. So that's one of my ambitions, is to have FreeBSD have a modern two-factor authentication solution,
yes,
in base, out of the box, and possibly even have it certified,
mm-hmm,
by the Open, what is it called? The Open Authentication Foundation or something. Mm-hmm. Open Authentication Initiative, I don't remember. OATH.
Do you think that's something you could have ready in time for 10.1, or probably not?
No, not for 10.1. No, it's too disruptive.
Right.
For 11, but okay, not 10.1. If you're only talking about having OTP in base, I could probably drop OTP in base by 10.1. But once again, I mean, I have key management tools, but they're not very good. They're ad hoc. What we really want to do is have implement the Oath PSKC standard, which is an XML schema for storing and transporting keys. Have an implementation of that and figure out, so if we're going to offer two-factor authentication, where are we going to store our keys? We don't want another ETC OP keys fiasco because, right, frankly, I mean, you know how OP stores its keys? It's just a single flat file with one line per user.
Right.
We don't want that. So how are we going to do it? We need a format that's extensible because there are things that, for instance, you want to be able to store the last time the key was used in order to prevent key reuse, and maybe at some later date you find that there's yet another piece of metadata that you want to include. So there are many considerations there beyond simply getting it to work because I need it for this system at work, and
right,
I can afford, it's just me and a couple of other guys, so I can afford to write something that I may have to rewrite entirely at a later point.
Mm-hmm.
I can't afford that when I'm working on FreeBSD. If I'm going to include this in FreeBSD, it has to be mostly right.
So
not perfect from day one, but mostly right from day one. Especially if it goes into 10.1, it will be supported for the next. If I have like a half-ass solution in 10.1, I'll have to support a half-ass solution for the next 5 years because of I will have to be backward compatible with the file format that I introduced in 10.1. I'd rather do it correctly in 11.
Right.
And have to support that for the next 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, because that gives you that window of wiggle room for the first while after you commit it.
Yeah.
You wouldn't get that with once it goes in release.
So,
how would that work for the way it stores keys, would you still have like a single key store that's managed by root, or would each user be able to add their own keys?
That's a very good question, because there are pros and cons, and I think that on the balance, it is best if you do not allow users to manage their own keys, because sooner or later you're going to have a user who's tired of remembering his passcode or passphrase or whatever, and writes a cron job that resets his key file so that it's always the same code, or right. You know, some stupid thing like that. People, right. Users do stupid things, or they'll try to edit their key file for whatever reason and they botch it, and suddenly they've locked themselves out of the system, or you have authentication for a reason, you have policies for a reason, and you want to be certain that you can enforce those properly. So yes, a single key store owned by root, and also with any OTP solution, be it SKI or OP or HOTP or TOTP, the key store has to be writable, because you have to invalidate a code whenever it's been successfully used. You have to invalidate it immediately. Mm-hmm. For HOTP, that means incrementing the counter. In fact, HOTP doesn't work if you don't have a writable key store. For TOTP, it means recording the last time the key was used, so that you can't reuse it within the time window. You have a 90-second or 30-second or whatever, usually 90-second time window. So you need a writable key store. So you need setuid tools and many, many policy questions. Do you want to allow users to change their own or generate a new key at will? Do you want to allow users to extract their key at will? Google Authenticator does not, for instance. If you get a new phone and you didn't print out a copy of your QR code when you first enabled Google Authenticator, you have to get a new Google Authenticator key, so it will show you the QR code again so you can scan it with your new phone, right? And that's a policy decision they made. The algorithm is very simple, but the ecosystem around the algorithm there are many complex questions, and that you had better get them right, or mostly right, from day one, or you're going to regret it later.
Okay, thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you for having me on.
We're back, getting ready to go into our news roundup. But before we do, quickly, of course, we want to mention the other sponsor on the show this week, which is, of course, IX Systems. And then they got a couple of new things for us. First up this week, we got a YouTube video, which we'll have a link to in the show notes, talking about how to upgrade FreeNAS 9.2.x, kind of walk you through the process. It's actually pretty simple, but you know, it's always helpful to have a video just kind of hand-holding you, getting you through it.
Yeah, it was a very popular question on the forums, people having particular problems, and it walks you through that. So that's quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And then next up, they also published some pictures from OSCon out in Portland, Oregon.
OSCon is going on right now, I think. I think it's not over yet. So they got pictures from the first couple of days. You can see the IX booth here with the free NAS, and they got giving away all the CDs and the horns.
All the horns.
And lots of people coming by and other things going on. People we've seen, like Michael Dexter from the Portland Linux Users Group, doing BSD stuff, and a bunch of the folks from Juber Broadcasting, the network where we run this podcast, out there running their booth as well, and lots of good times being had at OSCon.
Well, of course, this is just a small part of what IX Systems does, though. I mean, they obviously support a lot of conferences, go out and show off FreeBSD, PCBSD, FreeNAS, I mean, you name it, they'll... anything BSD, they're happy to talk
about. Exactly. So. It's another way that they're a big part of the community is actually just being out there and doing this where, you know, they're, if you look at their table and you see what they're doing here, they're not really trying to sell you a server. They're like, no, here, just take some CDs, go home, play with it. It'd be great. And
they also, they're out supporting the project.
They're giving away some paper copies of the FreeBSD journal as well.
Oh, very nice. And, very nice.
Accepting donations for the FreeBSD Foundation and all that great stuff.
Very cool. But of course, some of the other neat things they can do is building systems. Yeah. One of the best things they're good at here. Yeah. If you need something small, a nice FreeNAS mini to toss under the desk, which me and Alan both have here, runs great, quiet. And of course, they can scale that up to about as big as you need to go. And we've shown some of the monster systems in the past. Man, we'll have to get some more screenshots or captures here soon of some new stuff they're working on.
But, I don't know, that Terrafiler with the...
with the band set up in front of it?
Yeah, there was one that has like 750 terabytes of space or something evil like that.
Man.
It's like, wow, I want some of that.
Definitely. But that's the cool thing about IX. They can build the system pretty much to your specifications. Yes. So if you have a problem you're trying to solve, they're not just going to throw you something that's sitting on the shelf. Let's try and fix your problem. Let's provide a solution that, you know, at the right cost can take care of the situation you find yourself
in. Exactly. Like we've seen them build everything from, you know, a little FreeNAS mini with just a little bit of space that I can stick under my desk and that works great. Run my Plex Media Center off it or whatever, through, you know, some guy needed 24 10 gigabit NICs in 2U's. And so they built that.
Like, sure, they'll do that, you know, too.
The FreeBSD Foundation wanted one for the Poudriere cluster. It's like, yeah, we need like a terabyte of RAM and 40 processors, processor cores. And they're like, yeah, we can build that, no problem.
Sure, no problem.
Exactly.
But of course, because they employ so many BSD-related folks, they're able to be very knowledgeable about what's going to happen with the software interacting with the hardware. So they can make sure that, okay, you know, this BSD is going to run great on this particular motherboard, this chipset. And yeah, they're just really involved in the community, making sure that the latest hardware is indeed supported.
And well, not just the hardware, too. The software, like, you know, it's a lot of the effort that goes into making sure that the ZFS that's in FreeBSD is the latest and greatest is the developers that work at IX making sure that that stuff gets ported over so that they can use it in their products because they're based on FreeBSD. So it's as much benefit to them as it is to the rest of us to get all those latest and greatest ZFS features into the mainline versions of FreeBSD.
Yeah, which is very cool. So, of course, the URL, though, we forgot to give that a little earlier, but ixsystems.com/BSDnow. You'll want to go there. Let them know that we sent you. You heard it here on BSD Now. Fill out the form. Get in touch with their folks. Their sales guys are actually really knowledgeable about all the stuff that they can produce and sell and the various hardware and how that interact with the software and what it can do and what you might need to take care of the particular situation you're dealing with. So again, ixsystems.com/BSDnow. Go check it out. And we'll be back right now. We're coming into our news roundup, it looks like. So what do we have first? Some BSD CAN news.
Yes, so this is a report on the Ports and Packages Working Group from BSD CAN. So it's a little late, but, you know, there was a lot of things happened there.
Better late than
ever. There was, you know, 100-plus developers working on stuff for, like, 3 days solid. So there's a lot of stuff happening. Just a quick overview of what happened at this invite-only event. Baptiste Dusson started the session with a status update on how package building is going. Currently, all the packages are built within Poudriere, and using the FreeBSD Foundation sponsored a series of large machines to use for this, they can build the entire ports tree in about 16 hours.
Nice.
Although, once you then have to do that for multiple versions and multiple architectures, that's why we only get package updates once a week, because it takes that long by the time you count every supported FreeBSD version on every supported architecture.
Sure, sure.
So the way it works is every Wednesday at 1 a.m. UTC, which is, I think, 10 p.m., I think, something like that, Eastern, they take a snapshot of the ports tree and then start an incremental build, updating everything that's changed since the last build. And they do that for FreeBSD 9 and 10, for i386 and AMD 64, and so on and so on. And then the catalog is signed on a dedicated signing machine that's not used for anything else and is kept very secure and much more restricted. The packages mm-hmm. are then moved to the four mirrors. There's one US West, which I think is at ISC, US East, mm-hmm. which I think is at New York Internet, one in the UK, and then one in Russia. And then from there, people can start downloading them. He Very noted cool. that there needs to be more coordination between the source people and the ports people about ABI breakage. If something's mm-hmm. going to change in head, we need to make sure the ports people are aware of that and can add the right tests into their ports and make sure that the ports actually compile properly. And currently, the package building is only for i386 and AMD64, but they have plans to start doing ARMs and MIPS, and so they have to start dealing with that, the complications that'll cause. Back at BSD CAN, dist files were not being mirrored. So sometimes mm-hmm. you run into the problem where the file you want to download to compile the port or for the package builder to compile the port would be missing. The mirror would be down or something would happen or whatever. That's actually fixed now. There's a system called dist cache that is basically a fallback URL. So after the ports tree has tried everything else, it'll try that and download a copy from one of the FreeBSD mirrors. Which
they talked about changing that from FTP to HTTP.
Right, they did that as well. Like. By default, when you're fetching files for the ports mm-hmm. tree, it'll be by HTTP unless specifically specified otherwise, since mm-hmm. that more it works for more people behind more different types of networks and so on. HTTP is just generally better, and mm-hmm. so or better supported anyway, and so that has a bunch of advantages as well.
Very nice, very nice. It looks like he included some details about a package NG 1.3 as well.
Which was still under very active development back then, but was actually released this morning.
Today, yeah, so this is brand new stuff. So, but he also talked about the old package tools end of life.
Which is coming up as well. September 1st, they'll kill off the old package tools. And the new package 1.3, the biggest update that users will notice is a new dependency solver, which should almost entirely get rid of your the requirement to do package set, where you, if you're upgrading from, say, Perl 5.14 to 5.16, currently on 1.2, it'd be like, oh, there's a conflict, and you would have to tell it, hey, replace this with this, and then it would upgrade. It's going to figure all that out automatically now.
Nice. Nice. Okay. Well, next up in the weekly news roundup, we got a cool post here about cross-compiling ports with QEMU and Poudrier. So I guess they've added some recent QEMU features that allows you to basically cheroot into a completely different architecture. So the article goes through some of the process of, say, building ARM v6 packages on a normal x86 box. Yep. How cool is this? I'm actually very excited to see this.
So this going forward is what's required to actually get into building FreeBSD packages for ARM so that people with Raspberry Pis can just download binary packages.
Yeah. No more compiling X on your Pi.
Yeah, exactly. Currently, it has to be done on a bunch of ARM machines, and those are fairly slow. So this basically is kind of a combination of different things, depending on which way it's done. Oftentimes, shell scripts and stuff that are agnostic to the platform can be run at full speed on the AMD 64 architecture. But then when you actually get to running some test code or something that has to happen when you're compiling the port, that would actually happen in emulated via QEMU with this QEMU useLAN system. So basically, kind of adding support to the way that we deal with it when you're using the Linux emulator, right? It just says, oh, that's a Linux binary. I'll run that through the Linux emulator. This basically does the same thing, but when you try to run it, it'll actually start up QEMU to run that one binary.
That's cool. So I guess we do need to note, though, it looks like this recent work does require a 10 stable or 11 current and an extra patch for QEMU right now. So this is still some pretty bleeding edge stuff ongoing, but it's really exciting to see this happen.
Yeah, it requires this extra changes in the kernel, which obviously I haven't made it out to a release yet. But
looks like, I guess, November-ish, we're talking 10.1 coming out. So hopefully we'll have that here soon enough.
Yeah, it actually even has the commands here showing how to compile 32-bit ARM v6 packages. So if you have a Raspberry Pi, you could actually use your beefier machine to compile packages for yourself and then install off a local repo or something. And seeing that go forward will be very interesting.
That'd be fantastic. Also, the Poudrier developer now actually has the option. So when you go build that, it'll ask you if you want to do the QEMU user option, which will pull in all the requirements.
Oh, awesome.
I saw this last week when I was doing some upgrades. So good job, guys, getting that in. That's really awesome. So hopefully down the road, we'll be just having package repos for everything.
For sure.
Okay, next up, we have cloning FreeBSD with ZFS Send. So guess who? Michael Lucas has written something else this week talking about a FreeBSD mail server that he runs. He wanted to have an easy way to restore the whole system if something were to happen to it, of course. So the post is going to show his entire process and creating the mirror machine using ZFS for everything and how he did the ZFS Send and snapshot commands, which just went hand in hand with all this. Which is one thing that's really cool about the article is how he did the whole thing from a live CD. Pretty stinking awesome. Yeah. Anything else?
That is really cool. The idea is that if you have an important production server, you can basically have a standby server that's running a live CD off like MFS BSD or a live CD or something.
Sure.
And replicating everything so that as soon as something happens, you can just flip over and it's actually a bit for bit copy of everything that was on that system up to, you know, maybe 10 minutes ago or something. And then it's very easy to just take over and everything works great. I've been transitioning to doing things like this using jails as well, because you can just replicate them and then just turn the jail on the other side when you need to.
Yep, which is pretty stinking cool. Yeah, that's how I migrated a few recently on some of my home systems here. It's like, oh, new server, just replicate that data over and start the jail.
We've been looking at doing the same thing for installing new servers, is actually to build up the FreeBSD exactly the way we want it, and then basically take a snapshot of that and dump that out as a ZFS replication file. And then when we need to turn up a new server, we boot off the live CD and then just slurp that down and push it onto the disk.
I should probably mention that we already do that with the PCBSD installer.
Oh, is that how your installer does it now?
Yeah. We have an option with the system. Once you've got it installed, you use Life Preserver to make a replication to a remote box. And then the installer can just fetch that back. So you set up your disk options and it just replicates back.
Yeah, that's how you do like a restore of a broken system. Eh?
Yeah.
But yeah, you could use that for deploying new machines.
We've had folks in the offices use it for deploying as well. So they got a workstation customized with all the tools exactly the way they wanted them.
And imagine.
And then they just replicate them to new clients.
It's a lot faster than actually trying to install all the packages, because that's making all these random writes. Whereas ZFS is just a big fat stream. You know, when I'm doing it over the LAN, I max out the gigabit LAN. That's like 120 megabytes a second.
Plus they have everything configured for Active Directory or whatever they're using in the office, so they just literally pull it back and then reboot, and it's ready to
and
go.
As usual, it's Michael W. Lucas, so it's all documented very, very well in his unique style. And I can tell you that I'm pretty sure the reason most of this is happening was, A, he mentions, you know, part of this was setting up something for his employer, but it's also he's working on a book on file systems and stuff, and so managing disks and so on, and I'm sure this will make its way into that as well.
Sure. Well, cool. Well, next up in the news, though, we're continuing on with our FreeBSD overview. Of course, we've had the new blog series we've been watching about a Linux user switching to BSD. In part one, he gives a little background on being done with Linux distros, and he documents his initial experience on getting and installing FreeBSD 10. And in this article, he talks about how he's pleasantly surprised to be able to use ZFS without jumping through hoops and doing custom kernels and whatnot. So, I mean, how cool is that, just to have it right out of box? But most of what he was used to on Linux was already in the default FreeBSD except for Bash, which I'm sure you could solve that very quickly with a simple package install. Done. But part two, he's detailing some of the experiences with package and G imports. So we got some really cool links here. Any notables you want to pull out of these, Alan?
No, not in particular. That's it.
Yeah, but it's pretty interesting here. He said he wasn't able to identify the bootloader. It didn't look like Grub or Syslinux.
Right,
so he was like, I think this is something specific to BSD, which is.
Depending if he used GPT, which I think he did, then it's there's literally a very small loader called GPT ZFS boot.
GPT Linux.
It just boots FreeBSD, and that's all it does.
That's all it does.
Like,
but
I think
it's about
45 kilobytes. It's just, and most of that is ZFS code. I guess one thing he mentioned was the default shells, he had SH, CSH, or TCSH and so on. He's like, you know, where's Bash? Well, Bash is GNU licensed. So you can install it easily from the ports tree or with the package system, or you can even have Fish if you want. But it's just not included in the base system.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he talks about that too. He just ended up doing package install Bash, and then he checked, found the binary, and away he goes. So
it even adds it to etc shells, so it's easy to do. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Very simple. So you should check that out if you've got somebody who's a BSD curious and wants to hear about somebody else's experiences. It's a good way to get your feet wet with it. Well, we'll be back in just a moment with our feedback and questions for the week. Well, we're back now with our weekly feedback section, and we got several good questions this week. So first up, though, we have a FreeNAS backup from Boston. And he says, about a month ago, lightning strike struck three houses down my street. At that home, every electrical device was destroyed, even hard drives. Ouch. He said, at his place, just the computer, power supply, and motherboard was destroyed, not the drive.
When I had lightning, I think everything, all my machines are protected by UPSs, so they were all fine. But lightning somehow came in through the cable, over the cable line, through the cable modem, zorched my 24-port managed gigabit switch, which was expensive, and somehow went down and also hit the NIC in my machine, the NIC in my PF, one of the NICs in my PF Sense, but not the two other NICs that were all connected to the same switch. It was getting a packet the moment, like the gate was open the moment the lightning hit, and one of the two NICs in my file server. And I had to go to like the computer store and just buy a box of PCI Express gigabit NICs to replace NICs in all of my machines. the NIC on the motherboard on the desktop machine that I had then that got hit, the lights are still on. They won't turn off.
They just won't shut off.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I had to buy a surge protector for Ethernet and connect that between the cable modem and my switch when I replaced my $600 switch.
Yeah. Well, so he continues on. He says, so far he's protected my data on the FreeNAS box by setting up some data sets and shares as read-only so unintentional deletion can't happen. And for work folders, he's enabled regular snapshots. But this, of course, obviously doesn't protect his data from breaking my FreeNAS or ZFS or something or some natural disaster that could occur. So he says he'd like to back up FreeNAS to USB hard drives. Drives span from 350 gigs to 1.5 terabytes. He said, I'll plug them in at one at a time and back up to them because the box doesn't have enough available USB ports for them all to be plugged in at the same time. He says, what process do you suggest?
That can kind of depend. The nice thing about having your stuff broken up into data sets is it's easier to do this because you can find, you know, some data set that's less than 350 gigs and push it over. And so you might actually have to break up some of your stuff if it's not already broken up. But yeah, you can use, is there a tool built into FreeNAS for like Life Preserver related or not?
Well, it has replication tools built in.
So if you replicate that's a second FreeNAS, but I guess it doesn't. You could manually use...
Yeah, I don't think it has like a local USB.
Right, yeah, you could manually use ZFS Send or a script like the one that I help maintain now called ZXFer and basically replicate data sets to that external drive. And basically, it allows you to do incremental between snapshots. So you replicate it the first time, and then the next time, you hook up that same drive again, and you just change. You only have to replicate what changed between your server and what's on the disk, so that saves you time on the subsequent backups. And you can just do that individual data sets, although you have to keep track of which data sets are on which disks and hope that you know, one data set doesn't grow and now the two data sets that were on the one 350 gig disk have now grown so that in total they count more than 350 gigabytes. And you probably have to come up with a pruning strategy to delete old snapshots eventually so that you free up the space that you're not using anymore.
Sure.
And then the other downside there is if you delete the when you're doing ZFS incremental replication, if you break the chain by deleting certain snapshots, then you have to either go further back and replicate, or if you delete if there's no two snapshots in common to do the replication between, then you have to start over and re-replicate all the data, which can take you know, when I'm doing it over the internet, it can take days.
Definitely.
But you can do
that. So he basically mentions that as his first option. Then he also asks about attaching the drives to a PCBSD laptop and then backing up from FreeNAS to the laptop through the USB disks.
Well, if
that sounds pretty much the same.
If his only problem is connecting all the disks to the machine at once because of lack of USB ports, they make these things called USB hubs that allow you to do that. Now, obviously, you're not going to get the full bandwidth. But the advantage, if you did hook up all the drives at once, you could actually combine all the drives into a pool. And actually maybe make that redundant as well. So if you lose any one of those disks, you have the thing. If you're
still somewhat safe, yeah.
You will have to force it to create it if you're using disks of a different size. But basically, it'll use whatever the smallest disk is, amount of disk off each of the disks. So if you're mixing a 350 gig and a 1.5 terabyte, you're only going to get, you know, if you're mirroring them, because you only have two disks, then you're only going to get 350 gigs, and that might not be enough. But you know, with the right combination, you could actually create a pool out of them that way. And of course, the downside to doing a pool like that is that you would have to have all of the disks connected at once in order to read and write the data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He also asks, you know, what you should format the USB disks, UFS, ZFS, or even NTFS.
Well,
so
depending how you do it,
obviously we're going to say
ZFS. If you do ZFS, then obviously it's going to copy all the metadata. And the other advantage to that is, in the event of the disaster, you can just mount the ZFS pools off those external disks and access individual files instead of having to wait to restore all of it. And it just means they can be used live, which is helpful. And yes, the advantage with ZFS is that you'll still have the checksum, so you'll know when something's bad. You'll be able to do a scrub on it to read everything and make sure it's still good. But again, if you're not having any redundancy, ZFS will find the problem and tell you your backup is broken, most likely when you go to restore it. And so doing the scrub, being able to connect them once a quarter and do a scrub is helpful, but unless you're creating a pool that actually has redundancy by using multiple disks for your backup and having to connect them all at once, and ZFS isn't going to be able to do anything about it to help you. But it's better than just not knowing that your file was garbled if you're using, you know, NTFS or something.
Yeah, he had talked about using like rsync as well. I don't know. I guess I would lean more of the ZFS.
Yeah. ZFS and snapshots are better, they're better at using less space. With ZFS, if you do rsync with its option, when the file's different, it has to recopy the entire file, whereas ZFS, it only has to do the blocks that changed.
Sure. So, yeah, that would be the way we'd recommend going, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, next up, we have Rick, has some questions about network tuning. He says, I enjoy BSD Now. Thanks for the good work. Well, we appreciate that, Rick. He says he has a couple of FreeBSD network performance tuning questions for us. He has added some section.
Yeah, he broke it down into sections to make it easier to read.
So, okay, first section, background, multicast data stream. I'm working with industrial equipment that generates telemetry data as multicast UDP datagrams. Average flow is 2 megabits per second with periodic bursts up to 30 megabits a second.
Yeah, and I think he was saying that sometimes he was having problems where the application wouldn't receive it properly. I'm not sure what he's doing there.
Yeah, second section, he talks about FreeBSD full socket buffers. I'm running a client app written in C to receive the data on a FreeBSD 9.1 computer. He was experiencing frequent packet loss. Netstat-S showed an increasing count under UDP drop due to full socket buffers.
So that one specifically sounds like the app that's reading the data from UDP is not reading it fast enough. So you might
can't keep up.
Use something like Dtrace or just regular analysis on your C program to see why it's not pulling the data out of that buffer quickly enough.
So he said his troubleshooting he did was he ruled out a network issue by sniffing. He said all the packets are arriving at the NIC. He ruled out CPU saturation. He says it's never above 5%.
Yeah, so it seems like your application is busy doing something else or waiting for something else and not actually picking those packets up out of the UDP buffer. I think you can change the size of that buffer somewhat, but...
Well, that's kind of what he did. He said after a few Google searches, he was able to resolve the issue by increasing the following values on current IPC max sock buff and IPC NDP clusters. Let's see, INET UDP receive space.
Yeah, I think it was
so max.
The UDP receive space is probably the one that made the difference, but it might have also been the max sock buff. Because I think the default is 2 megabytes, and he put it up to what looks like 3.5 megabytes.
So what he's asking is there an authoritative source to learn about the implications of adjusting these parameters? The handbook has some guidance on NMB clusters, but you do not see information on the others. So he's basically asking, what are the unintended consequences of making these changes?
There's a couple things. Man tuning, the man page for tuning, has a lot of talk about it, especially the ones that he was changing there. Also, if you run sysctl-d, there are descriptions of each of the sysctls. Some of them give a good explanation. Some of them are a little vague. There was a project actually by Doug Erling, our guest from this week, to improve the documentation for the sysctls, but he ran into some hangups and never got around to finishing it. There are quite a few resources you can look at on top of man tuning and more stuff in the handbook. And you know, people have done some pretty good blog posts and stuff about how some of that stuff works. Yeah, I think I still think part of it was his application was waiting for something and not picking up the data soon enough. And then by increasing the buffer size, his application would finally get around to doing it in time. But and then what was his other question? netstat minus M will give you details about the memory utilization. It will actually show you how many of those NMB clusters you're using. You increase the number, but from this thing, you'll see how many are in use, how many are cached, how many have, what's the maximum number that have ever been used, and how many do you have available. And, you know, if that max number is not getting anywhere near the old default, let alone the new one you set, then you know that wasn't the change that made the difference. And that can help. And it breaks down summary and tells you basically how much memory is being used by your networking stack. And that can help you realize, you know, maybe I'm giving too much. I made these buffers too big, and now every socket.
Sure.
There's also in netstat, I think just regular minus A, or possibly minus, no, L's doesn't, but yeah, I think netstat minus AN, or just A, will show you the send queue and receive queue, which tell you how much data is sitting in those buffers waiting to be processed.
Okay. Well, very cool. Hopefully that gets them off in the right direction then here. Okay, next up, Clint has a question about Poudre and Adrail. He said, I was listening to the latest episode when Brian said you can run Poudre or Adrail. He said he was trying and failing at accomplishing this for several hours yesterday. He said it'd be grateful if we could update our Poudre tutorial with instructions on running Adrail. Have we done that yet, or do you have plans for that, Alan?
I had a blog article about my attempt to do it, but that was a long time ago. My one recommendation is make sure you're using Poudre-Devel, not the mainline Poudre. Because it has a bunch of the changes and improvements that make it work better in a jail, or make it possible to work in a jail. I don't know if there might, you might also check wiki.freebsd.org. There might be instructions on there on how to do it. One of the reasons why I haven't got around to trying it myself yet is that I haven't found somebody else's instructions. It is something I do want to look into, and I hope to have time to, but I have many other things going on as well, so. Hopefully we will have a tutorial on that because that'd be cool.
That would be cool.
And yeah, I might look at maybe even combining it, although that's probably a bad idea. But I'd also like to do one on doing the cross-building with ARM and combine that, or
that would be
do that
really
near good. Our Raspberry Pi tutorial when I get around to doing that as well.
Yep. Cool. Okay, next up, Esteban. He says, just a brief note to give us all a thumbs up. He said he's enjoying the interviews and the great tutorials. Before finding your show, BSD meant nothing to him. He said, I see the care put into the man pages, wiki pages, code, etc. He said the BSD world is different from the Wild West Linux world. Well, thank you, Esteban. Yes. We're glad to hear that. That's nice. We do. Okay, next up, Ben, asking about BSD desktop. He said, I was wondering what's Chris's thoughts on how to bring the next level of polish to the BSD desktop and laptop user. From an outsider, it appears that PCBSD has been doing some really great work getting the main desktop environments, such as KDE GNOME, to run on top of FreeBSD base. But is there perhaps some need for focus on the underlying FreeBSD and Xorg components? He said a number of... obviously. That's what I would say. One of the biggest things that still kills us is like a Wi-Fi driver doesn't work. Yeah. Somebody, you go to a show, you give a guy a disk, he pops in his laptop and it's like, oh, and there's no Wi-Fi driver, or I can't suspend.
My attack for that one is actually, I found that the Intel Centrino Advanced N6205, which is actually what I have in my laptop, my Lenovo, it works. You can buy the little cards for them for like $15. So it's like, next time I go to a show, I'm just going to buy a bunch and bring them with me. And anybody who complains, it'll be like, here, problem solved.
Yeah.
But there is a lot of work that went into updating the Xorg stuff. The new cons, VT, and the new Xorg. That's now the default 9.3 and will be in 10.1 when that comes out very shortly. Not very shortly, but eventually. And that'll make a big difference. And there's still ongoing work to get the Intel Haswell drivers up to date and pull up all that other stuff and bring in the newer Mesa and all that other fun stuff. So the work's being done, but Xorg work is kind of thankless, and it is. There's not
it's
really
subjective too, because there's so many different types of hardware out there. It's like, oh, it works great on this Intel chipset,
part of the problem with Xorg and desktop is that unlike certain stuff and getting stuff done on like ZFS or the network stack. There's fewer companies interested in making sure that works great. Whereas, everybody wants FreeBSD to be a great router. Only some people care about the desktop. Yeah.
Now, that's kind of the second part of his question he asked about. He's looking forward to new Xorg, UEFI boot, new cons. He says, what do you think the focus should turn to next after that? He's asked if we have any committers that are FreeBSD committers or Xorg porters. So I have a port commit bit. I know a few others in the community do. We typically don't work on Xorg stuff, though. There's enough higher level utilities that we're busy playing with trying to make those work. But you know, I'm not sure about the new FreeBSD core team.
There's a couple of people that have interest in desktop. I know there are a bunch of them run PCBSD as their desktop because it's an easier way to have FreeBSD as a desktop. So I know there's some work there, and I know I was talking to a couple of them about stuff, specifically the Linux emulation stuff for 64-bit and 32-bit, and just getting that more up to date so that they can run things like Spotify and just general stuff that, you know, that one or two extra little apps that just makes it into a more usable desktop.
Yeah, and he mentions, too, there's been a lot of talk about a new init system with parallel service startup, which is neat. We actually experimented with that a couple of years ago. He said he pointed out servers don't benefit it as much. He thinks the speed improvements, of course, on a laptop will be well received. Do you think PCBSD would consider being the guinea pig for this, and how would the PCBSD team cooperate with the FreeBSD team to ensure that they choose the right one? Well, of course we'll be the guinea pig for that. I mean, that's what we're doing right now, building GNOME 3 and some of that stuff. Yeah. We're pulling those out of GitHub and other locations. I think
the one that's being looked at is OpenLaunchD. For me, mostly as a server guy, I very much like the way the init system is now, and I'm perfectly happy with it.
Sure.
There's actually been some patches that just happened in the last week to do stuff like the service command. Currently, when you install something from the ports tree or the package system, unlike on Linux, it's not enabled by default. Well, currently that involves, you know, go edit this file and add these lines and so on.
Set an rc.conf value, blah, blah.
We've actually come up with a way to use, there's a tool in Base called sysrc that's specifically designed as a command line way to make changes like that. Well, we wrap that into the service command. So I don't know if the patch has gone into head yet or not, but it, basically you do service apache enable and it'll set
just do
apache 22 underscore enable equals yes in your rc.conf, and then service apache disable will disable it. And just some some easy stuff like that, that just makes it that much more usable for people. And I think that, especially on the machine of a developer who's just trying to work on stuff or get up a testing environment to test their application or whatever, I think little changes like that will make the big difference.
Yeah, it's smoothing off the rough edges, I think. A lot of just a little time sucks. It's like, oh, wait, now how do I enable this?
I understand people wanting parallel launch the and stuff, but personally, I'm very I like the way that I can do evil things with the current RC system. The fact that everything's just a shell script, you know. I saw a presentation at BSDCAN about putting like functions into your rc.conf, and and like they built a whole replacement for like Puppet in just shell script based on, you know, was the hostname of this machine a member of a group in the etc groups file, and if so, then apply all this code.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Well, from my perspective, yeah, OpenLaunchD or whatever, if those patches stabilize to the point where we can test them and they're intending on putting them in, then yeah, we are definitely receptive to working with any and all developers who have some neat stuff like that and want us to try it out. And we're willing to give that a shot, roll some ISO, see what happens.
But yeah, in general, I'm fine with it as long as I can still do stuff with like sysrc, where I don't need to grok some like ridiculous format in order to make changes to the file. I very much like that? The just shell variables as the way to control stuff. It's why I don't really like the new jail.conf because of the way it works. And it makes it kind of hard to edit it programmatically.
Cool. Okay, well, last up, I guess Matt sent in some pictures of his FreeBSD CD collection.
Yeah, so when you first look at it, just, you know, it's a bunch of CD spines. You're like, what's that? But zoom in a little closer. Let's see. And you see
4.0
yes,
here.
There's FreeBSD 6, FreeBSD 5,
2.28,
4, 3, and 2. It's got quite the collection of 4 here. 4.11, 4.9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and 0. He's missing 4.10, but he has everything else.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, nice collection there.
The 4s were always my favorite FreeBSD, I guess, because that's what I started with. I started on like 4.0 or 4.1, something like that, and I went all the way up through 4.11, and those couple of years there were probably the most fun I ever had with BSD. Although I'm getting to have a lot more fun now, too, as being part of the project and actually getting to work
on stuff. Committing and stuff.
It's a whole new level of fun.
Okay, well, that pretty much wraps up the questions and feedback. Yep. So as we close the show, of course, we want to mention that all the tutorials will be posted in their entirety at bsdnow.tv. So if you're watching this episode 6 months from when it airs, go check it out. You can still see the tutorials there.
Yep.
And we do try and update them periodically. Yes, so if they get a little stale, we try and fix them up.
Yeah, you know, when our PF tutorial was about 5.4, and then we updated it to be about 5.5 and stuff.
Yep. And as usual, you can send your questions, comments, show ideas, topics, or maybe a story you'd like mentioned on the show to feedback at bsdnow.tv. We'd love to hear from you. Last week, we talked a little bit about hardware compatibility, and we also have a link where you can check out the New York City BSD users' dmessage.
Yes, so this is a big database of the dmessages from various machines. Basically, users submit their information, and you can see what it looks like. So, you know, we can see here, there's... some guy's got his ThinkPad T61 and what the D-message looked like on OpenBSD. And the more people that submit these, the more information that's available, and they can eventually, it makes it easier to tell, you know, does this piece of hardware I'm going to buy, does the USB work? I guess USB works on almost everything, but they even have some nice, like here's a Supermicro X9 server. And you can see, you know, they're booting up NetBSD 6.99.44, which is their head snapshot, basically. And you can see all the different devices being detected on NetBSD.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Yeah, take a look at that. Yeah, if anything, good reference, like you said, if you're about to buy a piece of hardware or something.
Help everybody else out and submit your D messages.
Post yours now.
It's really, really easy to do. When you want to submit one, you fill out a form. You put in, like, a name if you want, an email address, description of what the machine was, so like your laptop and model, and then the D message. And it goes in the database and it benefits everybody.
Nice.
Plus they have they keep pretty much stats on the different operating systems. Because the New York BSD group is kind of OpenBSD centric, OpenBSD has about the same many count of D messages as FreeBSD. Let's see if we can't skew those numbers a little bit. There's only like 9 people that have tried Dragonfly. It's like, if you have a spare machine, just boot Dragonfly on it, get the D message and post it just so that you can help out. And then, you know, you can go back to doing whatever you're going to do with the machine.
Cool. Okay. Of course, if you'd like to come on for an interview or you have a tutorial you'd like to see, please let us know. We do want to do what the viewers want to see. So if there's something that you're really curious about, you got to let us know so we can try and schedule it for a future episode. And, of course, you can watch live Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern or 1800 UTC and see how we make the show and all the stuff that goes on in between.
Yeah.
Sometimes we record interviews early, so you kind of get a sneak peek at the interview before it officially
airs. If you watch this week, you got 2 interviews instead of 1.
That's right. That's right. So definitely a good incentive to try and watch us live. So, again, really appreciate having you guys all watch today and enjoyed being here with you. We'll be back same time next week.
See you next week.